Hello, this is Hillel Tecton speaking from the Critique website in the second podcast of the 22nd of November, discussing the question of the stage of the downturn. And in this second podcast, I will do what I promise, which is to discuss the theory underlying the situation itself. Now, I have already discussed the overall reasons for the downturn, so I'm not going to go over that except insofar as it is necessary. What I pointed out, to summarize very quickly, is that what we have at the present time as a carryover from the downturn breakpoint, as it were, is this very high level of money being held within banks or within firms in whatever institution they can find. And what they're not doing is investing. When quite obviously, if there isn't going to be investment, there can't be an upturn. That is the crucial point. And that's the point where we came to an end in the last podcast. Now, we have to ask when and where and how they might change their mind in this, or why they are doing this. Why are they continuing to do this? That they're doing this is, of course, obvious to them and to those who analyze it. Although it wasn't quite so obvious at the beginning of the downturn, when the press didn't report this in the same way, that is. Well, the question then is, why is the ruling class following this policy? I said we'd discuss the question of the ruling class and its strategy. Well, the problem with it is that it's obvious that there isn't one viewpoint on this, the part of the ruling class. And that is clear from the simple fact that we have this deadlock in Congress, and that we have, on the one hand, the Tea Party supported by a number of very rich people, and on the other hand, you have various very rich liberals who clearly don't agree with what's going on, like Warren Buffett, for instance, who said there is a class struggle going on and my side is winning. But equally, this last Saturday, November 16th, 17th, there was an interview with the Financial Times by somebody called Henry Blodgett, who owns and edits an online economics business type journal called Business Insider, which is clearly influential and quite useful. I have to say, having read it, I find it very useful. So he was taken to lunch by the FT, and he makes the point, that's to say, Henry Blodgett makes the point. Right now, he says, the biggest problem with the world economy is this tug of war between capital and labor. Capital is winning big time. Somebody who puts it like that, without obfuscation, is usually a liberal, since the usual attitude of the capitalist class is to uphold commodity fascism, or commodity obfuscation, if you want to call it by another name, whereas he's putting the issue clearly. Well, I began with this, and we can now see that it is a viewpoint which is also held by sections of the capitalist class. As I say, one would expect him to be a liberal, And Warren Buffett is, of course, a liberal. So what we've got then is at least two strategies. One which implicitly is saying that concessions have to be made, wages have to be raised, unemployment has to go down, the number of employed has to go up. The percentage of those unemployed has to go down, the percentage of those employed has to go up. Whereas on the other side, you have the exact reverse, as it were. They are basically saying we have to maintain a reserve army of labor with its necessary functions of controlling the working class, controlling ordinary workers, which up to a point they are doing today reasonably successfully, as implied in that quote. So, question is not whether one or other from their point of view is right, or is, but what is likely to happen in this? Well, all that seems to be happening is a muddle. And if we go to what underlies this, is the fact that the United States today is a declining power and isn't able to enforce its will as it would like in what amounts to global imperialism. So that the flow of profits and the control of it is more limited, and the prospects are, of course, more limited too. One can analyze the particular aspects of imperialism today, or the flow of profits from the third world to the first world, which continues at a reasonably high rate. Half the profits on the New York Stock Exchange come from outside the United States. But the essential point is that we're at a stage in capitalism where the dominant capital isn't able to impose its will as it used to, where finance capital, which is the dominant form of capital today, has imploded. The fact that capital switched from industrial capital to finance capital in the period from the late 70s onward, during the Thatcher-Reagan period and later, is crucial to understanding this. So what we have is a finance capital which was the form of control and which can no longer be sustained in the same way. But there is no other alternative. They can go back to industrial capital, building it up, which would imply that they maintain the firms up to a point that exist in China or wherever else, but they also build them up in the United States, in the imperial countries, United States, Britain, France, Germany, and so forth. It's not as if the world is awash with the necessary goods for the great majority of the population. It's quite clear that there is tremendous demand for goods which people need. So in principle, they could do it. But of course, the question is one of profit, whether it would be profitable, and how they could make it profitable, and whether they would be able to plan for that occasion. The issue is clearly there. When Obama came in, he talked of high-speed rail. In other words, building up the infrastructure. Now, that is an obvious way out, at least to begin with. But in fact, very little has been done in that direction. So, what can we say of the policy of the ruling class at this time? Only that is muddled. It has no obvious way out. What happened effectively, to repeat the previous discussions, is that the ruling class switched to finance capital in order to keep the working class under control by reducing industry, most particularly in the developed countries, throwing people out of employment, of course, particularly in the case of Britain, and raising the rate of profit, a large part of which was then extracted from industry and passed to finance capital. Since they didn't want to invest it in industry on any large scale outside of the third world, as it were, the result was they ended up with enormous surplus, and they found difficulty in investing in it, and it led to a series of bubbles, since each turn they took led to a bubble. The final bubble was when they went for a cannibalistic form of finance capital, which necessarily imploded. So they are effectively stuck with the only other possibility of a returning to industry. But that is precisely what they didn't want to do. So they are at an impasse. They can't use finance capital in the old way, but they're still stuck with finance capital. They're constantly trying to regulate it because of the dangers, in fact, inherent in it. That in fact, the banks will, one hour the bank will collapse, or the banks as a whole might collapse, as they very nearly did. So they have to rein it in and continue to rein it in. But it's also the case, particularly outside the United States, that the banks have not been fully restored. That's true in Britain, it's true in France, it's true in Germany, it's true in Switzerland, etc. So they have some way to go in this. One might have thought that the obvious policy would have been, in fact, to restore the banks as soon as possible. They could do that through nationalizations and through heavy subsidies. Now again, they've refused to do that. One would have thought that they understood the real situation which they're in, and they didn't have to keep moaning on, complaining all the time that the percentage of debt in relation to GDP is too high, and the result would be an absolute catastrophe if they simply continued raising it. That simply isn't the case under conditions where the potential output is considerably higher than what exists, or in other words, there is considerable unused resources. Of course, if there aren't unused resources and you do effectively print money, then you'll get an inflation which could accelerate. But that isn't the case. But they are not prepared to take this route. The point is they could take the route and they don't take the route. If we look at the case of Britain, the government keeps complaining that the ratio of debt to GDP is very high. Of course, it has been higher in the past at various times, but they totally ignore that. But the fact is that the Bank of England has been buying government bonds to the tune of close to 375 billion, which amounts effectively to the fact that the real government debt to GDP is a lot lower, perhaps 30% lower than it appears to be. Now, if they could do that, they could go further in that. But they are not prepared to do it. It is the orthodoxy that they shouldn't do that. Well, the question, of course, is why on earth they should have such a stupid doctrine. Nonetheless, that is what they have. It's clear that other sections of the capitalist class don't hold that doctrine. However, it is the one which remains, even if it is held below the waterline. So, we have to say that the ruling class is policy as it is coming out, and not necessarily in the minds of all its individuals, is confused and is simply muddling along. Given that it's still a muddle and the standard of living is going down for many people, this isn't a viable policy. Now, what I've just been said merges with the next point, and which is, how far can the existing policy, the policy of austerity, really continue like this? I just pointed out that, in fact, what it's doing is unnecessary. But, of course, if one looks at it, as I've referred to it before, as a means of restoring a reserve army of labor and restoring commodity fetishism as a form of control, and that this is a necessary feature, then one has to say the policy at least looks as if it makes some sort of sense. It is, as Warren Buffett and Henry Blotter said, a question of class struggle. And it's not just that the capitalist class is winning. They are imposing their will, and they are trying to return the world to the 19th century. Well, there is, of course, sense in it, if that's what they want, except for the fact that it only makes sense in the abstract, because we are talking about returning to the 19th century. The idea that one could reimpose a reserve army of labor without all the welfare benefits necessary, with all the different pieces which go into the economy, which effectively blunt the effect of the reserve army of labor. That one can effectively destroy the unions. It really doesn't make sense. The left in general has always been critical of the trade unions, who generally compromise. But, of course, we're now in a period when the unions are under attack. Looked at from the point of view, again, of a liberal ruling class, and, of course, the word liberal, as far as I'm concerned, is not a compliment. Looked at from the point of view of the liberal ruling class, this doesn't really make much sense, because they need allies in the population. They need institutional allies, like the trade unions. If what they are going to do is to increasingly antagonize them, do their best to smash them, which up to a point is happening in various parts of the world, if they're going to do that, they will end up with a situation where they've lost the institutional forms of control. where commodity fetishism cannot in fact be reimposed. One cannot reimpose the direct ideology of money ruling, necessarily ruling, nor can one simply reimpose the de facto rule of profits without any limits. So, although the policy of austerity at one point may have looked attractive, over time it can only crumble. What it would do if it were fully implemented would be to introduce a policy which couldn't possibly work, which so antagonized and so and caused such bitterness that the section of the ruling class which want to continue a policy of policing effectively the rest of the population would find themselves having to find an island in the Pacific in order to survive. It's not therefore a viable policy. It may have looked attractive and it has achieved a number of successes. However, in the medium to long run, it is hopeless, which is why the question is a muddle. Because, of course, they have begun to retreat already. It's not really viable to remove welfare benefits, make certain the trade unions cannot compromise, expose the trade unions to the working class itself, and therefore force the working class to find more militant forms of action. So, in other words, the austerity policy is not a long-term policy. A compromise is what they want, but they aren't clear what the compromise is or could be or with whom. And of course, given the austerity policy itself, there isn't any obvious section of the population or any obvious person whom they have effectively groomed, with whom they can compromise. So they are really in trouble. It may not look as if they are in trouble, but over time they are in trouble. The next question we have to ask is, what alternatives can in fact be put in place? Can there be any alternatives put in place? Thank you. Well, that will be the next podcast that I will do. Thank you.